so the meeting started, and there wasn't any meeting except the judge. And I will condense this a little bit for the sake of your time, your station's time, and your tape. He just said, gentlemen, you're the best in your business, or you wouldn't be here this morning. And I am not about to make the mistake of trying to tell people who are the best in their business how to do it. But, he said, I wish to point out to you that there are two ball clubs down on the field this afternoon. And for this year, they're the best in their business. There are two managers in those dugouts, and for this year, they're the best in their business. And he said, there are four umpires. This was long before they had more than four. He said, there are four umpires. He said, you recognize them in blue serge suits. And he says, by my selection, right now, they're the best in their business. Now, he said, I'll tell you what you ought to do. You ought to let the ball players who are the best in their business play. You ought to let the managers who are the best in their business manage. And especially, you ought to let the umpires who are the best in their business umpire. And I want to assure you that not a player, not a manager, and certainly not an umpire is going to leave that playing field and come up to your broadcasting booths and interfere with you gentlemen in your professional prerogatives. The full force of the commissioner's office is going to see that you are left alone to do your work. Now, your work is to report. Don't you play. Don't you manage. Don't you umpire. Report. And by reporting, I mean that I'm sitting in a rail box. And as everybody knows, I've got my chin down on my hands. And I've got my hat pulled down over my forehead. And some ball player, for some reason, suddenly decides that he doesn't like me. And he's got a mouthful of chewing tobacco already. And he comes over to the bench, right by where I'm sitting, and he adds as much water as he can get into his mouth with that chewing tobacco. And he doesn't hesitate. He comes right over to where I've got my head on my hands, leaning on the rail of this box seat, and he spits it all right in the middle of my face. Gentlemen, by reporting, I mean, don't feel sorry for the judge. Don't have a personal opinion about it. Simply report the path the player took, the width of his steps, the rapidity of his pace, the accuracy of his spitting, how much of the spit met its target, report my reactions, if any, and his reactions, if any, and that is what I mean by reporting. Gentlemen, good day. Now, Stu, this thing of criticism, a sitting judgment. I think that's a better way of putting it. From that time on, I had been given my philosophy of my work. I have reported, now I'm human, fallible, a frail vessel, but to the best that I have known, whenever I have had a question in my mind, I have gone back to that white-haired commissioner saying, report. And I have tried to report. On my conscious level, I can say that I haven't criticized a ball player. I haven't criticized a manager. I haven't criticized an umpire. I have been content to let them do their work. And over these years, they have been content to let me do mine. I have never had the slightest difficulty with anybody in a baseball uniform. And the one thing that brings to mind when this philosophy stood me in the most useful stead was in the fourth game of the 1947 World Series over at Ebbets Field. The Yankees were over there, and Bill Bevins was working on a no-hitter. And Bob Elson, oh, wait a minute, this was not Elson. This was Mel Allen, that's right. And Mel had the first half of the ball game. So when he turned it over to me in the middle of the fifth inning, Bevins had given up no hits. Well, of course, I am not unaware that there's a so-called superstition around that you don't mention a no-hitter after the fifth inning. I can understand that this has some acute psychological usage in a dugout. If you're sitting with the player who is attempting to go for a no-hitter, you don't come up and say to him, you know you're working on a no-hitter. But then it spread from the dugout up to the press box, and it's got on the radio box, and I never did pay any attention to it. But now, when Mal handed me this microphone on the Mutual Network, All Out World Series broadcast, 47, and this thing rolls into the sixth inning, and Bevins has given up no hits, I got to make a decision. Sure, I was aware of the superstition. And I suddenly thought to myself, well, now, wait a minute. What is my job up here, a dealer in superstition? And I went back to what Landis said, or a reporter. And I merely reported. I was bitterly criticized in some quarters that night for being unsportsmanlike. But let me say that if I had not told the story, if I hadn't reported it to the millions of people listening that afternoon, I would have done them a disservice. And I would say that Mr. Bevins and Mr. Lavagetto would not have had the glory and not be as well known for that afternoon as if the story had been clouded.
How did you react, Red, incidentally, when Cookie got that base hit to break up the no-hitter in the, I think it was the ninth inning, wasn't it?
Lavagetto got the base hit with two men out in the ninth inning and two men on. And he not only broke up the no-hitter, but he broke up the ball game.
How did you describe that?
Jean Friedel was easily scored. He was a runner starting at second base when Lavagetto swung. And of course, with two out, they both were going. And Mixes came around third. And we had the third base coach sending him in. And he slid in under Henrik's late and high throw. And Lavagetto wound up at second base. And then I remember that in the, I got it over and I just said that it's two runs are in, and Brooklyn wins 3-2. And then I think the next thing I said was that they're beating Lavagetto to death, and that's what the Dodger players were doing. It was a mob scene. And I'll always remember the picture of Larry Goetz, the plate umpire, after the winning run slid over the plate. He was so intent upon his job. In other words, for the good umpire, it's never the winning run. It's just whether the man's safe or not. And Goetz ruled him safe and then took his whisk broom out and started to brush the plate waiting for the next batter. And all of a sudden he realized when this mob went after Lavagetto that why aren't you going to be in the next batter? And to me, that's the best piece of umpiring I ever saw. The complete dedication of the umpire ruling as he's supposed to rule, only safe or out. Now, the other thing, which is a point of English, and Ed Mara was the, at CBS, hired me. I was the first man that Mara hired when CBS brought him back from London and installed him as vice president in charge of news and special events. And Mara was a pretty good judge of English and loved it. And this was a very strong bond that we had between us. And I don't know where the thing came from. I certainly couldn't have planned it. It just suddenly came out that after I'd had Lavagetto swept off the field by his adoring, boisterous teammates, I just took a deep breath, and then in trying to sum up the whole thing, because after all, that was quite a day, I just simply said, well, I'll be a suck egg mule. And Mara told me that he thought that was the best summation of any event he ever heard in his life.
Red, how has sportscasting changed in the 30 years that you've been on the job? Has it changed?
I would say that the two big changes have been television, which has brought an entirely different technique, and the growth of advertising. Now, let me say this, that in radio, to this day, it's no different than it ever was. In radio, you go out to do a ball game, and all you need is your engineer, the two of you. You can sit down. And I have never run into an engineer that attempted to help me broadcast. And I've tried to give them the courtesy in reverse. I've never tried to engineer. I don't know how to turn an amplifier on, deliberately. I mean, I think that's a fair way that you work together. And so, as the radio announcer, the only thing the audience is going to get is what the announcer tells him. I'd have an occasional sound that comes in. So, I'm not trying to pose as an artist, but I'm saying to, as a figure of speech, that the radio play-by-play man is the supreme artist. It's his show. He paints the picture. He does it. And if he doesn't paint it, then nobody hears it. And this is very satisfying work. And because you are allowed more freedom to talk, all your preparation, your 2 hours at the ballpark before the game, you have a chance to use this material. In television, you are the servant of the picture. You have a monitor in front of you. In other words, you have to see the picture that the audience is seeing. And the director, by just simply saying one, three, four, two, switches cameras faster than the eye can move. So you can't start a sentence on television with the assurance that you're going to be allowed to finish it before the picture changes. So you're just talking in little words and little phrases. And nobody has been able to establish correctly the proper balance of talk versus picture in TV. That's an argument that everybody's got a different opinion. So again, you're left with the fact that you're just trying to do as best you know how to do it. Now that is a technique which has changed very much, and also we get to the commercialisms. You have the pressure, and let's not minimize it, from the people who are paying this money, and it's big money, and that pressure comes down from the head of the company, right on down through his vice presidents and general managers, right on into the advertising agency, and you wind up with more young Ivy League guys in gray flannel breeches all taking a run at you than you have any idea. And every written word that some scriptwriter writes is sacrosanct. These are the things that have changed it. And they have changed it very, very drastically.
Red, do you think a young man starting out like you once did down at the University of Florida can become a sportscaster nowadays? It seems like most sportscasters are former athletes.
You have put your finger on another situation that has changed. I don't know how a young broadcaster today who is not a former athlete can get into the business, and I'm sorry to say it, and I think that radio and television have forgotten all about the most beautiful thing I know next to human love, and that is the English language.
Red, what would you say was the high spot of your 33 years of play-by-play broadcasting?
I've thought about this, Stuart, so this is not a difficult question. There are two. The first was opening day at Cincinnati in 1934, because it was the first major league game I broadcast. It also was the first major league game I'd ever seen. It also was the first professional ball game I had ever seen. So there has to be a beginning. In other words, there has to be, even the Bible has Genesis in the beginning. So that's one, that just flows. And second, I don't think there's any question. We opened the season after Pearl Harbor. This was the season of 42. And I was sitting in the booth about half an hour before the ball game. And a gentleman came to the door of the booth and sent in his card. It was a Mr. Reperga. And he represented the American Red Cross Blood Donor Center in Brooklyn. And he said, we have just opened this center in Brooklyn, and we are having a terrible time getting blood donors. We just simply can't hope to come up with the donors that we need to have, that the armed forces need, that the armed forces have requested, have demanded, have asked. And he said, would you just make a little announcement on the air today, because all Brooklyn will be listening, and just tell them that there is such a thing as a Red Cross Blood Donor Center. Well, until that day, Stu, because you were young and you don't remember, there was an unwritten but an ironclad law that nobody in radio mentioned blood, because it would be a distasteful, unpalatable subject to be going into people's homes. Fellows would broadcast prize fights in those days, but they never mentioned that a fighter was blooded or bleeding, or that there was blood. You just didn't mention blood. So I said to him, Mr. Reperga, I don't have the authority. I'll have to go ask about this. I said, will you come with me, please? And we went up the little catwalk steps and back into the press room, where Larry MacPhail was. And I knew it was there because I just left that room. And I said to Mr. MacPhail, this is Mr. Ruperga. And I told Ruperga, I said, would you tell Mr. MacPhail what you want? And I'm going to use a word now, now that we've had Virginia Woolf on the screen. The word is in the dictionary. The word is in Shakespeare. The word is in Chaucer. The word is in the Creed, in the Book of Common Prayer. So I hope I'll be forgiven if I use it. But I don't want to say what MacPhail said and lose any of the rhetorical emphasis. And MacPhail didn't hesitate when Ruperga brought this up. He said to me, he said, hell, there's a war going on, isn't there? And I said to Mr. Ruperga, just write down your information. And from that time, there never was a Brooklyn ball game broadcast in World War II that there wasn't an appeal for blood donors. And that kept on until the fifth or sixth inning when the Red Cross would call back and say, we don't need any more appeals today. Our books are all filled for tomorrow. And that is the second broadcast that's in my mind. And if there is such a thing in the world of radio, you holding this microphone and there's a tape recording machine going, if there's such a thing as blowing a kiss, and I'm not a lightly in public amorous figure, I like to think. But if there's such a thing as blowing a kiss, as I look back, I would like Stuart to blow it to Brooklyn.
Thank you, Red. Pleasure having you tonight.
You've been listening to a special edition of The Truth About Radio, a WNEW inquiry featuring Red Barber as interviewed by Stuart Klein. Stay tuned for News Close-Up after the news on WNEW. This is WNEW AM and FM Metro Media in New York.